Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to our 1980s special edition. 1984-85, we'd said on our podcast that, you know, so much happened and we wanted to do our 1984-85 episode proud for what happened on the pitch, but we also want to not shy away from the big events of the story of the season. We spoke to the wonderful Mike Harrison about his experience at the Bradford Stadium disaster, the fire, the horrendous fire. Please do go and find that episode if you can. He's wonderfully candid about his experiences of that terrible day. And in the same theme, we couldn't not give a wider conversation about the Heysel Stadium disaster, which is, you know, something that is, you know, very close to home for me. And joining me tonight is the wonderful Chris Rowland, author of the fantastic book From Where I Was Standing. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
The book, you know, is wonderful. Tell us your drive for writing that book and where you were coming from with it.
I think I basically couldn't square what I'd witnessed, what I'd seen and what I'd read and heard with the story that came immediately afterwards and continued to come for a long, long time. It was a much more sort of nuanced situation than the simplistic way that it was presented. And as the weeks and months went on, I just became increasingly exercised by this discrepancy as I saw it. So, you know, it was to set the record straight from my point of view, from an event that tarred us all Liverpool fans with the same brush. And that clearly wasn't fair. In our own personal case, our group wasn't actually in the ground when it happened. So you couldn't possibly, you know, whatever happens, we, you know, if we'd have been in the court, we wouldn't have been found guilty. We weren't in the ground. You know, we were on our way to it. And yet afterwards, probably to this day, we're all guilty, every last one of us. So there were about, I don't know, however many hundred were involved in the actual issue. It wasn't the 20-odd, 25,000 that were in there, that's for sure. But yet all of us, and all the ones who weren't there, and the ones who've been born since, are all sort of still held, if you like, accountable for what happened. You know, there's a strong sense that it's unfinished business to the point where we're still tainted by it and we're taunted over it still today, for all this time. Tragedy chanting has been, you know, a current issue. It does stem back to that, although I think people have got to be confused that those who are doing that are kind of merging Heysel and Hillsborough into one single entity, which they clearly weren't. It couldn't be much more different, to be honest. But I think it was Heysel was still being processed by our supporters when Hillsborough happened, and it kind of completely eclipsed it. It sort of, you know, it became more immediate concern, as it were. So that Heysel just got cut off into history before I think we'd really finished dealing with it, to be honest. It caused an awful lot of trauma to the supporters at the time and immediately after. And quite a few said they weren't ever going again, and I think some never did. Not that many, but, you know, some. So it was unfinished business, I think. That's why I started, you know, trying to write what I did. I think we got bracketed in also with general English football violence, which had been going on for a long, long time, particularly with the national team, actually, more so probably than clubs. But Liverpool had been in Europe for over 20 consecutive years at that point in European competition, and they'd never been involved in any serious issues at all, in marked contrast to several other clubs. So Heysel was the first time. So it was an anomaly, and that's what struck me. It was an anomaly in Liverpool's culture. Okay, we can then start looking into the background as to how and why it happened. But I think that's what it all started. This wasn't typical of Liverpool supporters at that time. Yeah, it was. You know, at that time, football violence was prevalent. It sort of dominated headlines, and it also, you know, the prevailing terrorist culture of the time, violence in and around grounds and what have you. But that led to measures that were routinely in place to try to prevent crowd trouble, crowd segregation being an obvious one, control of ticket sales, policing, all of which were pretty notably absent at Heysel, actually. All the things that we were used to back at home, week in, week out, every time you went to an away match, you'd be walled off, fenced off, floor to ceiling from the other supporters, with probably quite a substantial neutral empty zone and half the local police force between you and them. None of that applied to Heysel. We weren't aware of it going into it, that Liverpool's then Secretary Peter Robinson had been expressing his concerns over several aspects of it for weeks before the game. He'd written to them concerned about the ticket sales for a start off. Sales in Block Z, which is where the problem happened, were done on open sale in Brussels, which has a massive Italian population. Everyone knows that. 5,000 tickets were put on open sale in Brussels. He did express great concern about that. And UEFA pretty much ignored it. And, you know, those tickets were sold to the people who died, ultimately, because they were all in that section, in Section Z, you know, which was like a third of the end in which Liverpool's main support was housed. Liverpool were in X and Y, and the problem, the wall broke in Section Z, in the corner. So that was full of basically rival supporters, fairly unsegregated, as I, you know, referred earlier on about that. You know, we were used to massive segregation. There was virtually none, just a piece of chicken wire and a, you know, a line of police. It was not what we were familiar with at the time. But we, you know, then we had, the club itself had expressed its concern about this beforehand, and about the state of the stadium, by the way. It was its last match. It was always supposed to be its last match. So they hadn't been basically investing in it. So what you had was a crumbling wreck of a stadium. You know, when we got in there, you could see crumbled, you know, crash barriers with the sort of rusted reinforced bars inside where all the concrete had crumbled away. That's just on the ordinary crash barriers. You could push them over with one hand. It was just not fit for a big game. 60-odd thousand or the attendance was that night. And obviously, you know, most of it terracing still in those days. So there was, you know, it was going to come under pressure. Any crowd surge, any, forget fighting. If there had been just a normal game of football and there'd have been a, you know, an attack at our end, there'd have been surging, swaying like there used to be in the Kop, the ground couldn't stand that. It couldn't withstand that pressure. And it hadn't had to. You know, most of the time it was an athletic stadium or whatever. So for a long time, well, it hadn't been invested in. It was just rotting. And then suddenly they filled it absolutely full to capacity. Again, Peter Robinson wrote about that beforehand. He actually said that if that final had happened at any other ground other than Heysel, the tragedy would not have occurred. Simple as that. You know, it was a wall breaking that triggered the disaster that followed. And walls shouldn't break under crowd pressure. That goes without saying, really. It really, you know, UEFA ignored Liverpool's concerns before the game about the state of the ground, allocation of tickets, which placed rival fans dangerously adjacent to each other. So, you know, we weren't aware of these conversations between Liverpool FC and UEFA in advance of the match. But it happened all right. And UEFA were never ones to hold their hands up and say, yeah, we got it wrong. But they sat on their hands and pretty much ignored every single word Peter Robinson said.
Juventus as well voiced their concerns in the build-up to the final.
Indeed, they did.
Bonaperti, the club president at the time, doubled up on that. That wasn't just a Liverpool argument to be had at that point in time in that build-up.
No.
Yeah, I think there's a striking symmetry in the fears that Liverpool had put forward We're also being voiced in Turin, which tends to fall under the radar for a lot of people's understanding of the Heysel disaster.
I think the point is about this, though, is all the fans that gathered there from Turin and Liverpool were blissfully unaware of all this. We had no idea that we were being led into such a dangerous situation. You know, it's just like a normal European Cup final for us. It's a usual European trip, jollies, you know. We had no idea what was lying in store, what danger awaited. But there were those who did. Now, I guess they didn't. No, they wouldn't want us to publicise those things too much, I suppose, and sort of put everyone into panic mode. But yeah, this thought there were 60,000 people in there or over the gate. What it was about that? Totally unaware of quite how much danger they were in.
Tony Adams has spoken of a growing angst in the build-up to the game that wasn't necessarily prevalent earlier in the day, but maybe a couple of hours before kickoff. You know, what were your experiences out and around?
Exactly that. The mood changed, and it's very hard to sort of pinpoint how and why, but it stopped being the usual, which we were quite used to at the time. It gradually changed. It just became, in the middle of Brussels, I'm talking here, nowhere near the ground, the actual middle of town. It's very hard to pinpoint why. There were one or two sort of minor incidents that a jeweller's shop had been attacked or something, there was broken glass around the Grand Place. A hot dog stand had been attacked and somebody had been stabbed in the leg by the hot dog seller. The word got around that a Liverpool fan had been stabbed, and then someone else said an Italian had been stabbed, and the Italian had stabbed the English fan had stabbed the Italian. Now, words get round. It turned out to be the hot dog seller who actually did it. And it was a Liverpool fan who got stabbed because we saw him on the ferry on the way back. He had to have some stitches in his leg, but the story got around, and it's just like lots of little drip, drip, drips of unpleasantness, which kind of soured the atmosphere. The night before, the two lots of fans were getting on fine, playing football together on a campsite, and it was fine. But something changed during that afternoon in the atmosphere around the place. Nowhere near the stadium, nowhere near, it's several miles outside of the centre. But, yeah, so I'd agree with Tony Evans on that, yeah. But to actually try and explain why, it's very difficult, you know. You just became aware of it. It suddenly became oppressive instead of light and, you know, enjoyable with that little tinge of apprehension of a European final to come. Yeah, yeah. But if you said why, I couldn't really tell you. You just sensed it. Everyone went a bit subdued and quiet, which is odd, you know, sort of 4 hours before kickoff.
I mean, I've been to European finals. You know, I know those feelings of apprehension, of excitement, of, you know, even feeling like you may be in the wrong part of town, and, you know, shifting along to somewhere else, and everything involved. You know, particularly, you know, great experiences in Istanbul and
yeah, Madrid. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, less so in Paris. You know, a year or two ago. And you do, you just get that feel, and it's an unquantifiable thing sometimes. But yeah, I totally understand, you know, that feeling. There was such a domino effect to the Hillsborough disaster. You know, the two teams have played one another as far back as the 1960s in the Cup Winners' Cup. You know, they weren't strangers of one another. The two teams have played one another in the European Super Cup in, I think it was the December of 1984, in a peaceful game that was played, you know, rather than the two-legged encounter. It just was a one-off game in Turin amid a bit of a blizzard. And it was a game that passed off relatively peacefully. There were no instances of, that I know of, any, you know, crowd disturbances. You know, and within that, there was no sense of I don't know, animosity between these two sets of supporters.
No, I don't think there was in advance, no.
But within that, you know, at the same time, we've both been to European finals, and we know that there's a large cross-section of support that they bring, and a lot of different people There's a very different air to a Liverpool or any club's, you know, cup final in Europe or even domestically compared to what would normally be an exclusively set cluster of regular away you know, followers as such.
Yeah, like domestic sort of. You know, yeah. I agree.
And even within that, I've been to cup finals, both at home and abroad, and seen, you know, so many people that I know. And then I've been to other ones where I've barely seen anyone I know. How did Heysel feel to you in that respect? You know, was it somewhere where, you know, it felt like home from home, as a cup final can do sometimes from a Liverpool supporting perspective, or not so on this occasion?
Not in the sense that Istanbul or Athens did, or Rome. That said, you know, in the centre of town, it was nearly all Liverpool. We didn't see too many Italians around. But no, it wasn't, you know, in Istanbul, there was just no threat whatsoever of danger. People just seemed to be, Ranieri seemed to be us there. And so although we were travelling, there's a group of us, I think eight of us, the usual lot. But we didn't see any of our wider lot beyond that. But we hadn't arranged to meet them necessarily. You know, we were in our group of eight and we just moved around as, you know, as we would. But yeah, we had something to eat in the middle of Brussels, an Italian meal actually. And it was not... It wasn't quite as sort of euphoric as normal, but at the same time, it wasn't threatening. It was just a bit bland, really. It was sort of nothing really happening until in the Grand Place, I say, suddenly the police vans arrived and the smashed glass everywhere, some of the jewellers that had been done. And it never really recovered from that. We decided to get out of the way. It didn't feel right in the centre then anymore. So about 3 o'clock, we sort of jumped on a tram to go up towards the ground and sort of got off a stop short and sort of went for a beer, sort of about 20 minutes to half an hour walk away. So we were sort of out of the way, and it was a side street, really. We were part of the main thoroughfare. But when we did join it on the approach to the stadium, it didn't feel comfortable, even though there were thousands of us and they were at the other end. So it wasn't like the two sets of fans were meeting each other. It just didn't feel right. And then, you know, when we actually got to go in, we actually saw a lot of Italians sort of charging down a bank towards us. And we thought they were trying to bunk in and being knocked back. We thought we could be in trouble here. There's hundreds of them. And they just charged past us and they were just wild. I said, what's on earth going on? And we heard a muffled thud, which obviously was the wall going. We just carried on towards our section, but that we had to walk past the corner of section Z, where the wall went, to get to our terrace. And when we finally got into that mess, the pieces of perimeter wall missing as well. It wasn't just the barrier, the chunks of perimeter wall sort of falling in. And we got in, there's a burst water pipe right behind the turnstiles. So there's like a flooded mess of like mud and floating paper cups and a hat and a scarf, and it's just like tawdry. You know, it wasn't like the grand occasion that you would want it to be. Wasn't like Rome or Paris in 81 or Istanbul or anything like that. It was, you know, you don't expect to have to try and jump like a water jump as soon as you get through a. But it was quite deep, you know, it was spraying water everywhere and it turned into this red mud, sort of ready mud. And we had to try and get in there. Then we got a glimpse of the pitch, or what should have been the pitch. And that's when you realise things are not as they should be. Without knowing, of course, what exactly had happened. There's no mobiles in those days. So what's happened here, you know? Some crowd fighting and something's happened in the corner. No one knew that. No one knew what had happened. We were probably the least aware of anybody in Europe at that point of what was actually happening. And then that sort of news gradually got through during the course of the evening.
I mean, I've heard, you know, obviously I know a lot of people who were there and spoken to them over the years and you know, I've heard stories of people not even knowing until they were back on the ferry on the way back, you know, and being completely oblivious to her, basically until they got home, you know. And
well, yeah, there was a constant indecipherable babble from the PA system, but nobody understood a word. Apparently Phil Neal broadcast something, the Liverpool captain. Nobody heard that either. It was just, that didn't work either. It was, so nobody was aware. We didn't, by the time we left there at midnight, whenever it finished, I think at that point we realised there'd been some fatalities. No idea the scale of it, actually none at all, until we got back to, our rooms were in Antwerp. No, they weren't. They were in Ostend. Once we got back to Ostend in the early hours, and we got up and got a paper, and looked at the front headlines, bloody hell, tragedy in Brussels, and I remember seeing it. And then they started giving figures, you know. And estimated the point, at that point, I think it says 37. Bloody hell. You know, and the scale of it then became monstrous. But, you know, everyone was getting their commentary on TV. All around Europe, people were watching out on TV and getting their commentary and getting the running sort of information from the authorities or whatever. But we weren't. In that ground, we weren't. We just didn't know. There's only a Liverpool coach driver went back to the coach and managed to get BBC World Service or something, and he came back with some, you know, latest news. And at that time, I think there was sort of 15 or 16 of them dead or something like that. And that's enough to sort of floor you. And so this sombre sort of mood set in without knowing the full scale of the disaster yet. It's almost impossible to imagine now because of mobile phones and instant communications what it was like without that. You know, we were completely in the dark about the actual details, just aware that, you know, a general awareness that something, you know, distinctly non-football had happened and that the game probably wasn't going to happen and that we might not be in Europe again for a long, long time. I think we'd sort of, all these things were going through our head at the time without knowing, as I say, the full scale of it.
I mean, when it became, I don't know, apparent that the game was going to actually take place, What were your thoughts on that?
Well, this still divides opinion, I think. Some said it was an absolute insult to play the game, you know, after what had happened. Some said it was meaningless, pointless, didn't matter whether you wanted it. I get all that. But I think they were right to do it. I think it's the only decision they got right all night. And the only reason I say that is because it bought time. It bought a slight distraction, but it bought a couple of hours to plan how they're going to deal with what happened when 60,000 fans hit the streets afterwards, 30,000 of which are, how would we have been if their roles were reversed? We thought it was going to be distinctly unpleasant on those streets afterwards. And I think if they'd have just said, okay, it's all off you go, I think it would have been a disaster on the streets outside. And for that reason alone, I think it's probably the right thing. It just bought time. It just bought a little bit of time to disperse the sort of thunderhead of tension. The Italians stayed in the ground afterwards to sort of celebrate their win. I think it was the first one they'd won, I think, at the time. And we took the chance to try and get away while they were still in there, basically, and get out of the way as fast as we could, out of around the ground and out of Brussels as fast as we could. So, yeah, it was. A lot of people don't agree with me on this, and I understand exactly why, but it's just that it just bought time. It got time for them to be organised, the police and the armed forces, whatever they had by that point, to be on street corners where they needed to be to try and police it better. They had 2 hours to plan that when the match was taking place. Otherwise, I think it would have called them out. And it's anyone's guess what would have happened if the two lots had met. So for that reason, I thought it was the right decision. But I understand anybody who thinks otherwise.
12 months earlier in Rome, You know, there was you know, a lot of instances of problems for Liverpool supporters. To play Roma in their own stadium, you know, to go back to the Eternal City where Liverpool supporters had had a magical time in 77. You know, welcome with open arms, and a very different experience in 84.
Indeed,
when playing the local team in their own stadium and have the temerity to beat them. Taxi drivers, police officers, you know, hoteliers, you know, closed doors, and you know, Liverpool supporters were, kind of forced to take refuge in the British Embassy for some. That ill feeling, you know, played its part a year later. You know, your thoughts on that, Chris?
I mean, it's certainly true. After the game in Rome, it's one of the most excruciatingly scary times I've had in all the years I've followed football. It was quite horrendous. We didn't quite know what to do. We were outside our terrace. We'd come out, and we kept having groups of Liverpool fans coming back saying, "You can't go that way. It's bloody murder down that way. Try this way." Well, a lot had come back. No, that's out. So, well, you know, every way seems to be blocked. You know, what do we do? In the end, there was barely a window left in our bus by the time we got, coach, whatever it was, by the time we got across the river and back into town. It was terrifying, absolutely terrifying, a few hours. And whether some felt that these Italians can give you all kinds of problems, we need to be aware, we need to be, you know, I don't know. It may have entered a few. I said it didn't enter ours, but we were just aware that, like any other set of fans, you can run into the wrong lot at the wrong time, the wrong place, you know. And they were well capable of it. But then some, I think, actually went there with that in mind. And I'm not surprised. I mean, it was quite a scary experience after that game. Very unpleasant. You know, the noise of sirens and police dogs and shouting. And it was just echoing through the night. It was very unpleasant. Right. So, you know, I'm sure a year later it would have had some bearing on the way people thought, some of our fans thought that went through that. What I can't prove is whether those that felt that way were those that were involved at Heysel. You know, I just don't have no way of knowing that. But I think collectively we were kind of wary, shall we say, Italian fans generally. But of course, it wasn't Juventus, it was Roma, but no reason why they wouldn't be capable of doing the same sort of thing, I guess, would have been the thinking. So, yeah, I think it sort of coloured the background, shall we say. It led to a situation where some people might have been a bit sort of only too happy to sort of repay for what they'd suffered a year earlier. And some did get hurt quite badly in Rome. Not an attempt to justify it, but just to explain why some people's minds were where they were, but not all of them. You know, not all those 20-odd thousand that were in Heysel would have been in that position in Rome, but a fair few would, including us.
It's that concept of you know, you're never going to get that uniformity of approach, you know, for 200 people, let alone 20,000 people. And yeah, this is part of the, you know, the multiple layers of the Hillsborough disaster. Coming back to the stadium itself and UEFA's part in this and the Belgium authorities too, it was a stadium that hadn't hosted a European Cup final for 11 years. Even when Arsenal fans went to the same stadium for the 1980 Cup Winners' Cup final, there were you know, some you know, stories of discontent about the state of the stadium, you know, 5 years prior. I don't think West Ham fans were particularly impressed with it in 76 either.
No. And very little had been done to it since, of course, you know, because it was condemned. It was on its last outing. So why would they spend money on a ground that's about to be closed?
Absolutely. You know, the lack of a safety certificate and assurances from the Belgian authorities that, you know, order would, you know, prevail. The deemed lack of sale of alcohol around the stadium, only for that to be, you know, absolutely not true.
It wasn't true, no. It would be hypocritical of us to say we weren't delighted that it wasn't, but it wasn't. You know, they're all open, so we're going to have a bevy. That's what you do. That's what you do for a match. You know, it's not abnormal, except that we were led to believe there wouldn't be any. But, you know, I don't think we had any more or less to drink before the game than any other game they've ever been to. No, that didn't happen in any other game. So, you know, you need to look at reasons other than that for if you want to find out what really happened. You know, when you talked about the police, it's something which wasn't really made much of, but later the police captain had been in charge of security at the Heysel Stadium, was actually charged with involuntary manslaughter in Belgium. Wasn't widely reported here, but he was charged with involuntary manslaughter through the police's part or lack of part in the evening, which does sort of suggest that there was more happening here than, you know, than was being reported. The police command centre in the Heysel, there wasn't one. There wasn't actually a police command centre, and the police radios weren't working, so they couldn't actually get in touch with each other across the stadium. The police that were operating in Block Z were poorly trained and third division, basically. The bottom of the basket, as the French phrase has it. They weren't the pick of the crop. So they were pretty inactive, to say the least. So basically rival fans, you know, having sold those 5,000 tickets to local Italians, or either sold directly or sold on, were segregated by little more than a handful of ill-trained police and a flimsy stretch of chicken wire. So, you know, it was a perfect, you couldn't actually create a more perfect set of circumstances for trouble to develop. You know, the stadium couldn't cope with it. The police were not at it. And the stadium was, and the ticket control was zero. Apparently a Belgian architect afterwards, he said that areas reserved for standing or terracing remain as they were at the time of their construction in 1930. Crucially, neither the barrier between blocks Y and Z nor the wall in block Z was strong enough to resist crowd pressure. Well, you know, if they can't resist crowd pressure, there's 60,000 in there for a European Cup final. That's what a surveyor, an architect said afterwards when they were, commissioned the report on what happened. So that's what we were playing in, and Peter Robinson knew.
And UEFA's choice of venue for this is something that always strikes me as just belligerently odd. Since Heysel in 1974, that hosted the European Cup final, it had gone to the Parc des Princes in 1975, Hampden in 1976, a stadium that was starting to decay itself. But beyond Hampden in 1976, you're looking at, the Stadio Olimpico in Rome in 1977, Wembley in 1978, the Olympia Stadium, in 1979, the Bernabeu in 1980, back to the Parc des Princes in 1981, De Kuip, Rotterdam, 1982, Athens, the Olympic Stadium in 1983, back to the Stadio Olimpico in Rome in 1984. The vast majority of these, certainly beyond Hampden, so between Hampden and in 1976 and Heysel in 1985, these are, Wembley aside, futuristic, modern stadia, for that era, and some even now would still pass as modern safe stadia. Within that list, you probably point out Wembley as being the most unfit of the bunch there,
and Hampden maybe at the time.
Beyond Hampden, yeah. The reasoning and the thinking behind sending it back to Heysel in 1985 has to be one of the most perplexing parts of this whole scenario.
It wouldn't be the last time the UEFA would not accept responsibility for their part in something, and they didn't, and they never did. Hampden was ramshackle. But I don't think it was actually a danger, which Heysel most definitely was. It was actually dangerous. It was beyond ramshackle. It was dangerous. I say, if barriers cannot withstand crowd pressure, that's still all you need to hear. But it was quite often. It was 10,000 people there for an athletics meeting or whatever. It hadn't been tested like that for a while, a long time, during which nothing had been done. So it was the first time for a good few years that Heysel had come under a serious examination by crowd figures. You know, I can't remember what the capacity was that night. It was pushing 60,000, I think. And it hadn't had that for a long, long, long time. So I think maybe they just took it, oh, well, nothing happened in an athletics meeting with 10,000 people in, so it'll be fine. But it clearly wasn't. You know, the report from that architect made that quite clear. That end in particular, where we and Block Z were, was pretty much as it was when it was built in 1930. I say, when we walked in the ground, you could see crumbled away, crashed, barrier, the crossbars of the crowd barriers with like rusted iron strips in it. You know, you're not supposed to see the inside of them. And that was, that was in our section. That was not where the problem happened. That was just a general state of disrepair. So UEFA, I guess we found out in Paris last year that they haven't really altered their stance in all that time. It's anyone's fault but theirs. They had a part to play, for sure.
They had their part to play, yeah. And the Belgian authorities, you know, within that, you know, as well, you know, and I say this as a Liverpool supporter, season ticket holder, you know, I was three, you know, when I was three, taking through a turnstile at Anfield for the first time. The pain of association to the Heysel disaster and the human cost still comes flooding through.
And we did have our part to play.
All of what should never have happened. You know, the landscape that was constructed to enable this to happen. You know, painful, but the human cost as well, above all else, you know, is still utterly shocking to this day.
It is. It's still as fresh to me, you know, as it was then in my memory. It's interesting, you know, it obviously gets compared with Heysel, and as I said, the two often get conflated. This thing about, you know, you're always the victim, it's never your fault, actually, I think, relates to Hillsborough and is completely wrong. Or actually, no, it's actually right. We were the victims and it wasn't our fault. However, at Heysel, we can't say it wasn't. We weren't part of the fault. We could at Hillsborough, but not at Heysel. You know, we did have a part to play in that. But the two get conflicted. The other thing, the murderers that we get called, that actually happened on our way back through the London Underground. Just heard a woman's voice, a lone voice, just screamed murderers as we were going up escalator and she was going down one. And that was like the day after the match or 2 days after. That was the first time somebody had sort of used that word to us generically. And certainly not the last. And it still happens. You know, Heysel still cuts through right to this day. I recently had an interview for Belgian TV. They were doing a piece on it. Obviously happened in on their patch. And we went round to the Hillsborough Memorial and I got my reaction. And I walked round to the Heysel plaque on the centenary stand around the other side. And one of the interviewers said, it is much smaller and less significant. So no fresh flowers or cards or scars. Why do you think that is? I felt a bit ambushed, I have to say. I said, well, you know, maybe the friends and relatives of most of those who died at Hillsborough are local or within easy reach of Anfield and the memorial. They can come and, you know, and our fellow supporters can put flowers, and, you know, that's easy to do. The relatives of those who died at Heysel are not local. That's not to say they wouldn't bring flowers or scarves. But I wasn't really sure of my ground as far as the club was concerned with that. You know, that's the answer that I came up with. That, you know, the reason is that obviously people do bring flowers and scarves constantly to the Hillsborough Memorial. It's, you know, it's huge. Because the people were from around here. It's people who can get to Anfield quite easily, get on the bus or whatever, and do that. I guess if you're a relative of someone who died at Heysel, an Italian, you're not necessarily going to want to get a flight over to Liverpool to put your flowers on. It's not comparable. But I can see what you're saying. The club makes a huge thing. There's the, you know, eternal flame, and, you know. But just this little wooden plaque on the other side for Heisel. And they were sort of basically suggesting we might care more about Heisel, the Hillsborough, than Heisel. And they wouldn't be the only ones to have said that. And it was hard to sort of argue against that, really, based on, you know, on what we saw. It did feel like a bit of a trap. So they obviously knew what was going to happen. I didn't know we were going to walk around to the other side and see that, but they did. So, you know, in that sense, Heisel and Hillsborough are connected, not least because Hillsborough, I think, became trapped in time, engulfed by the enormity of Hillsborough. So there's a certain sort of connection, but I think when we're getting taunted by other supporters, most of whom weren't actually born at the time, of either of them, so you can only guess where they get their information from. But, I think it's that they don't actually know the details of either of them, and they just conflate the two and just say, oh, you lot are involved in both, and that's it, and that's enough. It's not. You know, you need to drill down a lot further if you really want to understand it, you know, which is what I started writing about in the first place.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's no doubt that Liverpool could do more than they do, but it's where you, I don't know, as a football club, as a supporter base, where the club, I don't know, can position themselves, where Liverpool supporters feel they should be, you know, on the subject of Heysel. It's clearly uncomfortable. It's clearly, you know, a club and a supporter base, certainly for those who were, you know, around at the time of this disaster, you know, to feel like they've resolved themselves to it. And within that, accepting, you know, the role of the Liverpool supporters who made the way into Section Z that night. You know, there's a lot of soul searching still to be done, you know, all these years later. In that respect, but you know, as we've said, it's not a black and white issue, and you cannot paint, you know, one full set of supporters with the same brush, because there is simply no two same opinions. You know, it's like different snowflakes.
Exactly.
You know,
yes.
You're going to have a completely different pattern of thought for every person who was there or lucid or watched it on the television unfolding as I did that night. You know, it's such a complex subject matter that, you know, all these years later, I know personally from my point of view, I've still not resolved it and got my head around it completely. And whether I ever will, you know, I can never be certain.
I was hoping the book might help me do it, you know, to try and sort of get it out of me, but it's not really.
It's a topic that brings up more questions the more that you feel that you come up with answers. The unease remains with, you know, authority, you know, within this as well, an unease with UEFA. It does come back to as well. Even
is that simplicity I was talking about, that you know, there was only one reason for it all in, you know, at the time presented in this country, and that was English hooligans, Liverpool hooligans. That's it. That's the only issue, the only factor, and it was a factor, but it wasn't the only one.
No, because this is a, as you said earlier, on a supporter base that had no real track record for violence of this magnitude,
or since,
obviously, you know, isolated incidents will always happen, but there's never been, you know, as a football club, Liverpool, you know, other clubs have the notorious sets of hooligans. You know, be it, you know, the revel in it and emboss themselves. We don't need to come up with the names. You know, we all, you know, those of us, you know, who know enough, know, you know, the names that certain groups of supporters at certain clubs give themselves. And Liverpool never had that, and still to this day, never have that. And it's such an out of place event as well.
I think you see sort of certain groups of supporters or the clubs who arrive, particularly abroad, but even something like Cardiff when they used to have the cup final there, they sort of behave like an all-conquering army of occupation. We're here, we're taking over your city kind of thing. Liverpool never did that. They never took that approach. I remember one of the lot we were with in Istanbul, he said, so I can't see the point in trying to not get on with the locals. He said, they're going to drive your taxis, they're going to serve your food and your beer, they're going to look at, they're going to run your hotel. What's the point in making enemies with them? He said, let's get on with them. And that seems to be, that always did seem to be the way. It wasn't a case of, as soon as the train arrives in the main station, you'll slam the door and sing in your heads off. But didn't we just quietly sidled into the side street, basically. It's not this great big sort of army occupation thing that some seem to go for. And that made it all the more difficult to rationalise. It was so out of keeping with what I've always known, before and since, of Liverpool supporters. It was the same applied in Cardiff when we had the cup finals there. You saw certain groups who were just there like we're taking your town. Well, it's just not the way we think. It's not what we do. Just get on with them. And most of you've asked people in Athens or Istanbul, they'd have us back any time.
And within that, just going back to UEFA again, that even within the joyous event of Istanbul, that lack of common sense and thought into the stadium itself, that was no more part of Istanbul than Wigan's part of Merseyside.
No, I was just going to say that. Is it actually in Istanbul?
I was in Istanbul as well. What was striking
20 miles outside?
It's about 20 miles or so. And what still strikes me to this day was the rocks that surrounded the stadium.
It was the moon with a football ground on it.
It was the surface of the moon. But in terms of kind of like the rocks that you could just pick up and the size of your hand, and thinking if this were to go wrong, the bloodshed that would be. And that was part of the striking, as we said earlier on, that propensity for UEFA to make the wrong decisions so often.
That's the thing, it's so often.
The events of Paris that I suffered, I was part of that crush in Paris a year or so ago. And again, it's happened to other clubs as well. Manchester United, I think, in France, had similar instances of crush problems. And it is that sadness that mistakes aren't completely learned. And there was no bigger mistake than Hazel.
I think there were examples of similar things that the FA got wrong regarding Hillsborough. I think Spurs and Wolves had played there earlier, and they'd had a near miss. It's just that I think football's governing bodies, UEFA are particularly culpable, I think, in this respect. But the FA made the same sort of error. They didn't learn from what was a potential disaster with Spurs and Wolves. A couple of years earlier, a year earlier, wherever it was. They just keep pushing it until it finally happens, and then they just run away and hold their hands up to do with us. It's an aspect which drives me nuts, to be honest. I'm not alone in that, I know. But this was a spectacularly bad choice. And as you said, warned by both of the clubs. It couldn't have been clearer. It couldn't have been made clearer how unhappy they were with that decision. There was a request, obviously, to shift the game from Rome once Rome had gone through, but I think that is more difficult to actually move the venue of the final, given that you don't actually know which sides are actually in it until about 3-4 weeks before it or whatever. It's difficult to shift a venue for that. So I'd kind of offer them some support in that respect, but not about Heysel.
The cities of Liverpool and Turin, in the early days after the disaster, Peter Hooton and Kevin Sampson, musicians, authors, had made immediate efforts to build bridges. A group of Juventus ultras were invited over, turned down the invite initially, but then agreed to come to Liverpool in an act of friendship and attempted reconciliation that worked very, very well at the time, but was sadly never really built upon. A missed opportunity in so many respects, that the groundwork had been done, but the building upon that never quite happened.
It's difficult, this, because there's the famous occasion when we played them subsequently in Europe, and the in memoria thing in the COP, and a lot of them turned their back. Not all, but a lot of them turned their backs on it. I just wonder if the roles had been reversed, what we would have done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Purely speculation.
Totally. Would certainly feel quite confident in knowing what the response would be.
So I think, I think we'd have been, I don't think there's much point in us getting sort of upset about the Italians turning their backs.
Not at all. I was at Anfield that night and couldn't blame in the slightest. And I know it wasn't all of them either. And the split wasn't as wide as you'd imagine either. It was quite an even split, really, accepted the gesture and turned the back on the gesture. It was, but yes, thank you so much for spending time with us, Chris.
No problem, not at all. Thanks for the opportunity.
Please do go out and locate Chris's book from where I was standing for more material and insight on the Heysel disaster, a disaster that, as most disasters are, whether it's football or not, completely and utterly avoidable. And when it comes to Heysel, there was, just how avoidable it was didn't need hindsight. Both clubs going into that were wise enough to know that this was a disaster waiting to happen. And sadly, it wasn't. It's something that, so the City of Liverpool Football Club, Juventus and Turin, and beyond have never got over, and the victims of Heysel went beyond citizens of Turin. There were Belgians, there was an Irishman.
Northern
Irishman that lost his life that terrible, terrible day as well. And the deep impact that it continues to leave on people who were witness to it. And that was something that Mike Harrison mentioned with Bradford, that even for people who just watched on television, the scars are very real.
Absolutely.
It was an unreal event to see unfold. From my point of view, just watching it on television has left a massive impact, and clearly more so because it was my city, my club, involved in it as well. But Chris, thank you so much for spending an hour discussing this highly sensitive topic that we really needed to, when we've come to do the 1984-85 episode, we couldn't just drop 5 or 10 minutes of conversation into that episode. And, we just like the Bradford episode with Mike Harrison, we had to do this. And thank you for being the one to come on and talk about it.
Thanks for the opportunity to do so. I've just always felt, which is why I wrote the book in the first place, that this is not something that wants to be buried. It needs to be out and discussed.
It does, no matter how uncomfortable.
It's going to be.
It is for people. It's.
But, I don't think we get anywhere by presenting it didn't happen. That's underpinning it, really. Much as we'd all love to just forget about it, you can't. And it won't actually help us process it by leaving it, by forgetting about it and trying to forget it, and then it didn't happen.
Thank you so much, Chris. Brilliant conversation. All that leaves me to do is say thank you for listening. Please do join us again for the continuation of our 1980s series. I'll speak to you again soon. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.